Okay. I'm going to repeat my underlying assumption that I want to give a little bit of a very, very, very basic intro to the three waves of feminism, and then I want to delve into the text and kind of see what we can hear with that background. Okay? I have two experiences. One is a more obvious one, that some of the feminist theory helps me see implications of the texts in a way that I wouldn't have necessarily understood or thought of without. The second, which I find personally more surprising, is that sometimes I feel there's new interpretations that are born when I hold some of that baggage of a feminist theory. And I want to give two or three examples of each one of those. Okay? Okay. The first wave of feminism, the liberal feminism, mainly dealt with equality, shivyon bifnei chok, equality regarding law. The biggest endeavor and achievement of that wave was women's vote. We owe a tremendous amount to that wave of feminism. There is a rejection of the notion that women are worth less, okay? But it's not an essential rejection of what is considered less and what is considered more, okay? Division that feminism very strongly pushed was a division between the private and the public. Liberal feminism didn't reject that the public is worth more, right? That in the public sphere, more important things happen. It just says women should be allowed into the public sphere, okay? There isn't a rejection if you think of culture versus nature. It still accepts that culture is more valuable, that what's logical is more valuable, that being active is more valuable, okay? It just says women should be allowed and understood as able to have those qualities, okay? You see already that there's a thinking that's very binary, okay? There's passive and active. There is culture and there's nature. There's logical and emotional. And all these binaries have hierarchy, okay? And these binaries also are given not only hierarchy, but they're also given a sexual or a gendered weight, okay? So liberal feminism mainly said women have these qualities that are considered hierarchically better, okay? But it didn't change how we understand these hierarchies. For example, there was a claim we should change education so that women aren't educated to be passive. I interviewed not long ago a young woman, Fur Hadar, who grew up in one of the most feminist Orthodox high schools that exists today. And she described to me how the message between the lines is go out, work, have a career, take responsibility, but do something that leaves flexibility for a family, okay? So I feel that part of this is still stuff that we're dealing with today. Now, what happened was that this wave was very successful in the sense that women got the vote, but reality didn't change, okay? Still, it was mainly men in government and mainly men in managerial positions and so on and so forth. And then there were attempts to understand that. And that was part of what led to the next two waves of feminism. Okay? And the first one I want to talk about is radical feminism. Now, radical feminism questions both the binaries as such and the sexualization of those binaries. And it puts into question in a much more radical way, radical feminism, all structures in society. Okay. I want to tell, we'll tell in a minute the story of McKinnon in this context. But let's just leave that at such, I'll give an example of the questioning of the binaries, okay? So there's a claim that I'm not either here or here, but that all of us are somewhere on a spectrum. And that is true. Not only am I passive or active, well, I'm sometimes this and sometimes that and usually somewhere in the middle, okay? And am I emotional or logical? Well, I'm sometimes this and sometimes that and usually a good mixture of everything and, again, somewhere on this. But it's also true about my feminine and masculine qualities. And it goes as far as to say it not only about mental or emotional qualities, but also about physical qualities. Okay, there can be women who are very strong, and men who are, and so on and so forth. Okay, you build all the stereotypes, and you see that people are just much more complex and on some line and different qualities, different places. Okay. As a counter thought to that came cultural feminism. And cultural feminism maintained those binaries and questioned the hierarchical aspect of it. Okay, in other words, it came and said, emotional, that's great. Passive, that's sometimes the right way to do it. Nature versus culture, nature very often is very wise. Okay, so it didn't question what I gave stereotypic weight of masculine versus stereotypic weight of feminine, but it came and said, maybe the hierarchy should be tipped. I just want to tell the story of Gilligan for very, very, very quickly for those who don't know it.
You mean Carol Gilligan and not Gilligan's Island?
Yes, I mean Carol Gilligan. So Gilligan did this research on ethics. And she asked teenagers the following, some version of this question. Your mother is really, really sick. And you don't have the money for the medicine that she needs. What are you going to do? And some kids said, we're going to rob the pharmacy and get that medicine. She can't die. And other kids said, there's nothing we can do. She has to die. You can't steal. And other kids said, well, I'll go to the pharmacist and I'll negotiate and I'll say I'll work and I will make a payment plan. I'll talk to him. I'll try and convince him to let me. And classically, the kids who said, well, you have to steal, or you're not allowed to steal, were the boys. And they were considered morally superior because they had clarity of what's right and what's wrong. And more of the girls talked of going to the pharmacist and talking and negotiating, finding some middle, and they were considered less moral.
That's the work of Coles.
Yes, exactly. And Gilligan, I want to leave aside a minute the question of if she said it specifically about girls or about what is feminine. Okay, that's a change in her philosophy a little bit. But she basically said, she created the term ethics of care, which is now a more common and prevalent term, where the claim is what makes something ethical is the quality of relationships. Is being motivated by relationships, okay? And that maybe that is as moral as those clear morals of you're not allowed to steal or you have to steal, okay? And maybe even more, okay? So there wasn't here a rejection of what is feminine is what is masculine, but just of the hierarchy of how we think of those qualities. Okay. Questions, comments, thoughts?
Liberal, radical, and cultural, are those first, second, and third wave as well? Are those different terms for different definitions?
Liberal was the first, and cultural and radical developed a little bit in parallel, and radical is more third wave, it's considered, and there's later, more extreme kind of developments of it.
Well, I wonder, in terms of women or feminists studying Talmud, I also see different ways? Because I remember when I was at HUC and there were no women and there were no women faculty, the first wave was finding women or finding something about women. It didn't really matter what it was. It was like if you found a woman's name or something, that was like big excitement. And then you had Judith Hauptmann who said, maybe these stories about women aren't such great resources because they're shaped by different people's points of view. You want to find the things that aren't DAFCA stories about women, but where women are just kind of there, and then you can really find out something about women. And then now there seems to be like Tal, I can't think of a last name, this whole new series of feminist commentaries where it's sort of like everything is just looking for gender in a general kind of way. Yeah, and I don't know, how do you feel that connects to these different waves of feminism?
Hannah Safrai, who passed away 10 years ago, wrote her doctorate about women in Beit HaMikdash. And she found she was a bit of a historian, but a Talmudist also, and she showed all these texts in which women appear in the Mikdash. Classic liberal feminism, okay, and she demonstrated how they're there. About 15 years ago, something like that, I did research with her, in which we took. She said, let's go positive. Let's take, some of you may have learned some of this with me in the past. Let's take all the midrashim, which include women, and let's analyze them. And we took all the midrashim that have this very specific term of en li ela, that include women, and we went through a process of analyzing each one of them. And what we actually learned, which we'll see also in some of these texts, is that the mechanism of inclusion actually winds up excluding. Okay? I mean, we can see it in our Pesach text, right? Let's turn to page. I didn't bring them. I'm sorry. I'm going to check 1 second if maybe I have an extra one here. Well, no, this is the morning one, right? I'm sorry, I don't. I didn't bring. Okay. So, Nachon, so page 5 says that Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi says women are obligated in 4 cups of wine on Pesach. Why? Because they were also included in the miracle. And now comes Rashi and says, what does that mean that they were included in the miracle? Oh, it's thanks to the Tzadkani women that we got out of Mitzrayim. Or with Esther, right? Esther is the one who did the salvation. Now, that's not including as an equal. So in other words, if I am not exquisite, have an out of the ordinary role, I'm not part. So clearly, this inclusion is not to be included in what is normative. Okay? Now, I think we're in the stage of that realization, okay, of questioning whether liberal feminism is enough. And we're at the beginning of the next waves of feminism. You know, Tali Lan's project is amazing, and Tali Lan basically is giving all the tractates of the Talmud to different people to read and analyze. Now, whether if you're from the liberal feminism school, that's the kind of reading you'll do. And if you're a more radical reader, that's what, so it's going to be a very diverse product, okay? So that's part of my answer. I think we're behind a little bit. The feminist thought, the Jewish feminist thought is a little bit behind. But slowly it's getting there. That's what I want to say. I'm optimistic, but yes. So I want to give a few examples of how these different reads play out. And I think maybe I'll say one more thing with regarding that question. That's partly why it's important for me to do this, because I want us to be conscious of what we're doing and of the choices we're making when we're deciding to give room to women and in general to hearing these other voices. In other words, I think it makes a big difference if we are including as equals, if we're including because we're questioning the whole hierarchical and patriarchal system. It makes a difference, and I want us to be aware of what we do when we choose different avenues. Okay, so I want to give the first example about Ben Tzorer Umoreh. Maybe then we'll move to Pesach and we'll end with Akedat Yitzchak. Okay, so now maybe share with me a little bit. When you read these verses about Ben Tzorer Umoreh, where did you feel that the portrayal of the case ends and the description of the verdict, the law, begins? Yes.
I'll put it out there. I think we decided that the case ended at the end of verse 20, mm-hmm. and that the law began with 21, and they will stone him. So you had to meet all the criteria up through the end of verse 20, and then.
Great. So you're saying we have a situation with all its details, and basically the verdict is once they found him guilty, you stone him. Okay. So the verdict is the stoning. Okay. Any other thoughts? Yeah.
Yeah, we thought that it might perhaps begin at verse 19, mm-hmm. that was procedural and part of the whole legal process.
This
is what you do when you have this problem.
Okay, really interesting. You have a Ben Tzorer Umoreh, you try once or twice to, I'm sorry, this is, yeah, v'yisru oto, you're saying even the punishment that they do at home is still part of the description of the case, mm-hmm. and 19...
Yeah, because it didn't work, so now what do you do?
Great.
That becomes a legal case.
Yofi. Now let's use some of the language that we just acquired.
Where did you end it, the case?
After 18.
18 is the
18
case
is the
parents' discrete. Attempt to deal with it, and that bombs.
Okay.
So.
Now, what I can say that feminism made me aware of is that that is a choice to say what happens at home is your decision, and then you taking the kid out to the public sphere, that's where the law begins. Okay, that's that choice. Okay, you could put it even earlier, right? Before the ve'yisru oto. Okay, and say if you have a wild and unruly child, the law already enters into the house and says you have to try and educate this kid. Okay, you have an obligation to punish this kid so that he straightens out. And if that doesn't work, you take him out. Okay?
So maybe it's not so clear. Maybe
it isn't, right, Nachon, that's why all these options exist.
No, I felt that it started in verse 19, mm-hmm. but now I'm reading verse 20 and saying, well, that sounds like a mixture of the two. In the house, out of the house, the parents are turning to some kind of external authority, zikne iro. It's not either public sphere or private sphere, I don't think.
So yichol, it could be that we have here a law that is blurring the lines of those two spaces. Okay, good. Nachon, yes.
I think that's an important point because in the history of at least U.S. feminism, the portrayal of the home and the imposition of narratives onto the home, either productive or counter to feminist goals, has happened, both like in portraying the stability of the home and a nurturing mother as like the anchor of American society. Mm-hmm. And then once the woman starts like, you know, pushing back on those boundaries, society, you know, your children become undisciplined and society itself unravels. So I think sort of the blurred lines between the home and society is sort of an important marker point where a lot of, I think it is true, like the patriarchal society tries to impose on the home because they feel like that's really where the battle can be lost.
Good. So I want to suggest three reads of the law, okay, that respond to part of the comments you're saying and to the three waves of feminism that we discussed, okay? So the first, what is the goal of this law? Okay, and it's exactly echoing what you were saying. Okay, we could read this law the goal being to strengthen patriarchy. We have a kid who's questioning his father. We know that his father is the little patriarch, symbolizing the bigger patriarch of society, okay, or the patriarchy of society. There is panic that if a home crumbles, the whole structure of society crumbles, okay? And so the big patriarch outside comes to protect the little patriarch of the house, okay? And the point, the entire point of this law is to help the father sustain control of his home, okay? The classic definition of patriarchy is older men being in charge of women and younger men. Okay, so the children being folded in is the way patriarchy functions. That's possibility number one. That, just like you were pointing out, blurs the line between the private and the public. Okay, I don't want it doesn't only blur it, but it ideologically says I have to take control of the house because otherwise everything crumbles. Okay. A totally opposite way to understand it is to say the purpose of the law is to protect the weak elements of society. The goal is to make sure the father doesn't kill the kid. Okay, and I want to say two things by way of background here. One is in the verses. Okay, if you opened up the verses from Bereshit and from Dvarim, okay, A, B, and C here, what we see is examples of parents being in control of the life of their children, right? Yehuda can give the verdict, you have to kill Tamar. Reuven can give the verdict, kill my children if I don't bring back Binyamin. Okay? And in Dvarim, in Deuteronomy, you see that there's legitimacy for Goel Adam to, right? If I had a family member who was killed, there's legitimacy for me to kill the person who killed them. If he gets to the Ir Miklat on time, great. But if not, I have legitimacy to do it. Okay, and that it's possible that Dvarim 21, the verses of Berben Tzorer Umoreh, are a later development, an internal mikra development that says I put control, I put limits on the patriarchy's power. Okay, it's definitely how the Mishnah perceives itself vis-a-vis the Roman law that is happening around. Okay, in Roman society around the period of the Mishnah, fathers have the right to kill their children, their slaves, their wives. They have control over their life, okay? Now, I want to say a second thing by way of background here. And here I want to say something about McKinnon. McKinnon, who is a later wave of feminism, okay? Not liberal feminism, but later than that, comes and puts a question on how the Supreme Court legitimates hapalot.
Abortions.
Thank you. And the court says abortions are allowed because it's private and everyone has the right to privacy. And so women have the right to have abortions. And McKinnon comes and says that is useless. Because if I don't have access to money, and if I can't go to the doctor, and if I have to ask my father or husband for permission, privacy doesn't help. In privacy, evil things happen to the weak elements in society. Okay? And so I want the hand of the law to go into the private sphere. Okay? And to legitimate things or control things there. And that's an opposite way to read this law. To say the main thing here is to protect the kid from a parent that is furious. Now, both the first and the second way of reading it blur the lines between the private and the public. Okay, yes.
I'm a little bit hearing echoes of some of the different readings of sota, which is it an expression for male anger or is it a containment of male anger?
I don't
do you see that also?
I agree that it's very similar. Yeah. Nachon.
Is there any connection that you would draw with Megillat Esther?
What do you mean?
Achashverosh is threatened, and his response to being threatened in his own home is to make a public and national or empire-wide decision about how men ought to control their homes. It could have been, I'm having trouble with my wife, and I'm going to deal with that, you know, sof pasuk. But it's extended much beyond that. And
Nachon, for sure he interprets what is happening.
Societally.
Bidyuk, societally. The panic there, right, it's Memuchan, no? Who says, yeh kol ish sorer beveito. Okay? Yeah. I'm writing my doctorate on Ben Sorer Moreh. And I have a chapter that plays with the comparison of Sorer v'Sorer, comparing Be'emet, the narrative.
Nice.
Yeah. I don't know if it'll be at the end in the... Ken. Please to my... Yeah. Good. Okay. So now I just want to present the third option here. Okay. The third option I want to suggest is... Maybe the law actually wants to take advantage of the difference between the private and the public sphere. And to make the following claim, when you're in an impossible situation in the private sphere, take the kid out of the house. By definition, a ben sorer is a child who is revolting against their parents. If I take him out to the zkenim, by definition, they're no longer a ben sorer. In the realm of the zkenim, we can start working on the relationship. Okay, we can start analyzing what's happening. I think that might be the cultural feminism read of it. Okay, that the zkenim, I want to take advantage of the distinction because what he is doing by definition happens in the private, and when I take him out, there can be salvation both of the kid and of the relationship. I wonder if the Talmudic statement, lo haya velo atid liyot, is actually, if you follow the law, you'll never have to execute the kid. Okay? It's like going to the shrink or to the social worker or to the teacher or to the rabbi. Okay? It's to diffuse it somehow, actually taking advantage of the public sphere. Now, I apologize that source 2 wasn't translated. Okay, but those of you who kind of worked through it, we can read together the last few lines, but I think this is part of the dispute that is taking place here. Okay, I'll read just the lines that are underlined at the bottom of page 1. Okay, said Rabbi Yoshia, Amar Rabbi Yoshia, Shlosha dvarim sachli ze'ira mi'anshei Yerushalayim. Ze'ira of the people of Yerushalayim told me 3 things. Ba'al shemachal al kinuyav kinuyo machul. It's exactly, Sue, what you were suggesting, okay? Because they associate a ben sorer and sota very closely, okay? So a husband who can help me translate, machal, forgives his wife's, he lets go of the ceremony, okay? Of demanding the ceremony, that's fine, he can let go of it. Ben sorer o moreh shiratzu aviv imo limcholo, a wild and unruly child whose parents want to forgive him, great, they can forgive him. Mochalim lo. Zaken mamreh shiratzu bedino limcholo, an elder who has also gone against the court. The other elders can forgive him. Okay? Now, this is a mixture of things, of cases that happen in the private and in the public. Okay? There's a blurring here of the lines.
But isn't the Zaken Mamre of the 3 the most public?
Can, exactly.
So that's why at the end it says, on the first 2, Mochalim lo, and the third one, not.
Yofi, and I think that might be an understanding of the Machloket, right? Because the continuation is, but when I, says Rabbi Yoshia, came to my friends Badarom, not those Jerusalemites, but down south, 2 they accepted, and the 3rd one, the Zaken Mamre, they didn't. Now, why didn't they? Maybe because there's a different understanding of the implication of the forgiveness in the public sphere. They say there has to be a distinction between the private and the public. And in the private, you can let the patriarch forgive, but in the public, you can't. Okay, and that might be the essence of the machloket here. Okay, do we accept the difference between the private and the public sphere, or do we not? Okay.
I'm sorry, what was the distinction that you drew? You said the end was different. I'm not seeing that. Mochlim lo, mochlim lo.
It wasn't forgiven.
Al zaken mamre lo hodu lo. Lo hodu li. That's the 3rd case. That's different.
Sue, from the kshibati, look at the word kshibati in the middle of the one before last row.
Yeah.
Okay, when I came to my friends down south, al shnaim hoduli, they accepted two of the things. The al zaken mamre lo hoduli. Okay, I didn't read it slowly. Okay, fine. So that is the move into the public sphere. Yeah.
I had a different question going back to the Ben Sorel text. So, b'kol aviyu b'kol imo, does that matter? Because later on in the Talmud, they discuss it, but don't say the same thing, they don't sound the same, all these other things.
Look, I think that there's different ways to think of it. We can say the mother here has agency, right? And there's an insistence on it throughout, right? It repeats it again and again and again. It's striking, okay? You never know with women in particular in history, but in general with people who have less agency and power in general, if their stands are actually free. Okay. Okay, did she actually have the power of veto or not? I don't know. Yeah, you guys raised that question in your chavruta.
About a different text.
Right.
Okay, so I don't have a clear enough answer for you on that. If she's utilized for a purpose or if she actually has agency. I'm not sure we have enough information to tell. Okay, should we leave this and go to our next example? Let's spend a little bit of time on Pesach and then we'll end with a Kedat Yitzchak. Okay? So actually, I thought we would start with the Agadah. Okay, on page 9, I brought you just a little text of the Agadah. And the Agadah, right, the heart, the core of the Agadah is the verses from Dvarim. What's the original context?
Bikurim.
Bikurim, Shavuot, nachon. Why do you think this was the text chosen for the Agadah?
The whole conversation from the other shiur.
Yeah. Oh, you did it. Okay.
No.
You discussed it with Ellie.
No, some people.
Well, I'll tell you my theory and tell me if it came up as one of the theories. One thing that I think is striking about this text is that it's in first person singular, okay? Yofi, so it's the narrative, and okay, great. And now, did you discuss with Ellie the interpretation, or no, you did this text?
Yeah.
Perfect, no, so tell us just a word about what, give us the bottom line, perfect. We'll make two shiurim out of the one.
No, I don't know how, I mean, we focused a lot on what constitutes, what are the boundaries and definitions of Gnai and Shevach, and that, that was very free-ranging and probably not.
Right. Right. We don't have here Matchil B'Gnut U'Misayim B'Shevach. Yeah. Correct. Did you you guys want to say anything about the interpretation here that they're offering to the Pasuk? Did you guys read it? Did you get a chance to look at it? It's the last text in your little packets. I don't know how many of you got to it. Look, they basically are interpreting every word in the Pasuk. Nachon? So, Vayered Mitzrayima, what's their interpretation?
It had to happen. He had no choice.
Bidyuk, don't think he went down there because he wanted to go there. No. Anus al pi adibur. What's the dibur they're talking about?
God to Avraham.
Good. Brit ben Abtarim, right? Okay, yofi. Vayagar sham, what does it come to teach me?
Temporarily.
He didn't move to Egypt. Chas v'chalila. It was temporary.
Yeah.
Okay. Bimtei me'at?
Only 70.
Only 70. They went down very, very, very few. Yeah.
It feels important to mention this doesn't include the women.
Right.
The 70 don't include the women.
In the context of this shiur.
Nachon. The 70 don't include the women.
You
how do you
want
know?
Women to be invisible, or the lack of women to be invisible.
Say that again. Say who? I just missed the first word, Sue.
No, I mean, I'm partially teasing Ron because of a conversation we had before, but I'm also saying in seriousness that he did not want the women or the lack of women to be invisible. Dafka in the shiur, right? That's where you're.
Nachon. How do you know that it's not with the women?
Because we got another shiur earlier today. We counted. I mean,
the beginning of Shemot is all men.
Right.
You have the list, Nachon. Right. The beginning of Shemot.
For what it's worth, I don't know if I'm addressing a concern you have. I think it's good that there's some overlap because we can bring things together.
No, it's fantastic. Ken, no, I'm just saying that Shemot actually has the list of the people,
yeah.
And Kilo, we see the women aren't there. Nachon. What?
No, Sarah.
Sarah isn't. I'm wondering if Dinah is mentioned in the 70. No.
In Bereshit and all this, they're mentioned, but I counted, I think.
Zeo, Nachon, I also think that in the list there is a mention of
they're mentioned, but they're not counted in the 70.
Okay, great.
Or Amy pointed out in the 600,000.
Yeah, Nachon. Okay, Yofi.
I wonder who wrote this.
Nachon. Right. No, I think the main thing that I want to say is that there's a lot of work to do. And that there is a step of realization, and that can take us two ways. It can be so depressing that it freezes us. And it can be, okay, now what? Okay, and we all, that I think we're in this very complicated interim time of existence in this realm,
I think that too, and I don't know sort of where this belongs, but I guess I've felt in the last few years that our attention has been sort of diverted to very important other issues around gender that's not just about women. And so sometimes, I'm very happy that we're having this, because I almost feel like people have felt like, okay, we're done with like the women, we dealt with the women, and now we have other issues, and those other issues are very important and need to be dealt with, but they need to be dealt with at the same time as we're dealing with a lot that needs to still be addressed.
Women aren't over.
Right.
Yeah.
But can I say, Avital, I want to hear what your gender studies reading is of this text in the Haggadah, because Ron's started us, but I have a feeling that's not the only thing you wanted to say about this, and I just don't want to miss.
Yeah,
that.
No, don't worry. Yeah, I agree. I feel, I'll say what I'm thinking, which is I'm less gentle than you. I sometimes feel in my environments that there is a preference to go to include minorities because it's easier, more legitimate, less terrifying than including the 50%. Because with the understanding of what radical feminism says, it's really an understanding that we have to rethink entire societies. It's bidyuk where you move to with Esther and Achashverosh. I think that's what it is. Achashverosh or Memuchan, they realize it, that it can change things drastically. Okay. Vaisham legoy gadol. What does that teach us?
Just legoy.
Nachon, sorry, I always do that. Legoy, nachon. So what does the word goy teach us? Metsuyanim. There was something distinct about Bnei Israel in Egypt. Okay. Gadol ve'atzum.
Numbers.
Numbers. They were very many. I think atzum is also strength. Nachon.
It's in the other midrash.
What?
What Ron showed me before from Eli Shiur, there was a different text that
of the atzum. Yofi, I wonder if a timalea aret is only quantity or also quality. Okay. Now, what about Rav? What did you learn from this? What is this pasuk doing here from Yirmiyahu? No, what did Ellie say? Come on.
We didn't get there. We only studied the text. We haven't actually
gotten that into tomorrow. Yeah. Nachon. Okay, I'll forgive him. Look.
Please forgive him.
So, I mean, yeah.
Well, we in our chavruta a little bit talked about it with Ethan, not yet with Ellie. So, but he's reading this midrashic move as Rav doesn't have anything to do with numerous. It has to do. It's in order to bring all. Somebody called this a humble brag. It's in order to bring. It's just the Rav and Ravava, and to bring this whole passage from Yechezkel, in order to talk about the incredible low place from which God brought us forth. So he was reading it as
great. So good. So let's choose. I'm going to just suggest a middle, which I was discussing with Dina in the Bet Midrash, which maybe the Rav is an issue of maturity. Okay, if you look at the psukim, at the pasuk here, right, there's a description of maturity. Okay? Revava ketzemach hasadeh netatich.
I actually think it was interesting that they could have used so many different psukim for Rav, but they chose Yehezkel. Like why this for the Midrash,
right,
as opposed to another one, right? So, like, I think, when I think of Rav Yehuda, I think of, like, the bracha for, like, Rivka, like, you know, and...
And what is it there? How do you understand the pshat there?
Well, that you should... Well, it's numerous. Like, you should have...
It's numbers.
You should have generations, right. But it's a bracha for a woman, like... Which this for me ties into all the midrashim on Pesach, like with Pesach and the women, right? Like because if it wasn't for the women, we wouldn't be numerous. Because the women basically took charge to make sure that we had children.
Good. So we're going to look at that midrash in a minute.
So to me, this sort of, it ties in here, which is but not with the text that they actually bring. You know, I think it's just sort of interesting that.
Good. So I think part of the. So we had already Gadol, nachon? We had right. The numbers. Mm-hmm. That's why I wonder if here the content is maturity rather than the numbers, because the numbers we said in the previous right. Pasuk. Okay?
But does this Pasuk prove anything about maturity?
Well, v'tirbi v'tigdeli, it's a description of a mature woman.
But she's going to grow into a harlot. Isn't so kindly.
So, first of all, Nachon, in other words, what's interesting is that chapter is a very, very difficult chapter. Now, somebody very clearly had a very strong hand in the psukim they brought in, mm-hmm. because if anybody opened up Yechezkel,
right.
You will tell me that the verses here are flipped. Okay, they're in flipped order.
Absolutely.
Now, whereas I would naturally say, when I'm learning Gemara, I'll tell you, the chapter makes a big difference. But it feels like here, somebody actually wanted me to end with the words, B'damai chayi, B'damai chayi.
Right.
Okay?
Is that about covenants? Do you think that's about the brief? Like it's like...
Yes.
Right, so...
It's the words we say at a brit milah.
Right. No, right, but I'm saying, but does that mean... But are they trying to bring the concept of brit into this somehow?
How do you hear brit in B'damai Chayi? Just because of that, those are the verses
yes.
we say?
Yes.
I don't know... Does anybody know when we started saying those verses in a brit milah? I don't know if it's parallel in time.
Oh, that's
okay?
A really good point. Yeah.
Another thing I want to say is, I actually wondered if it takes us to the Dam of Mitzrayim. Which is, okay,
well,
where there's a skipping. Okay, the dam is bemet what makes them live.
You have no mitzvot, you're not, you're arum
ve'eriyah.
Arum ve'eriyah mi mitzvot. So we'll give you dam brit and dam mitzrayim. And then you deserve to be redeemed. So there's a...
Connection, nachon, yes.
No, I just was wondering if you could talk about the use of it in a brit milah. Because it's, and again, you know, like we're talking about, they're flipping the verses so that they could come out with a very interesting understanding. When I, you know, that piece of Yehezkel is based, you know, from what I understand, is saying that it's only God who could save. It's only God that could take you out. Is it really, or you who actually cares about you? Everybody else hates you, and scars you. Really tough to say in front of parents who are you know, having a brit milah right now, and you're having the entire group of people saying to this baby, or at that moment, you know, nobody cares about you except God. Is it really? I don't know. It's just a very. It never bothered me before until I came here.
Great. Don't you think that's the baby's point of view?
Well,
if my parents are doing this to me, then who cares about me?
But I want to point out one more thing. That in the original, in the Yechezkel, there's a baby who no one cares about, and the blood is the blood on the baby after birth. And when we do the flip, it becomes the blood of the mother after birth.
What do you mean when we do the flip?
Oh, in order.
Uh-huh.
When we flip the order of the
psukim,
yeah. The way we read it here, it's a mature woman who has given birth and in her blood after birth. Okay, whereas in the psukim in the original, it's le'efech, it's you, this baby, covered with the blood from right after birth, and then you grew up, okay? So I think the flip maybe turns it wants us to turn the point of view to the parents, to the mother. Okay, when we say Bedamai Chayi, who are we talking? I mean, we're talking about Yisrael, but are we also focusing on the mother? Because we flipped what that blood is. Now, I'm leaving it with more questions than answers, because I want to spend... I wonder if part of the baggage here is the Midrash from Sotah. So let's look a minute at 9. Who looked at source 9 already? Most of you or not most of you? That's what I want to show. Yeah, most of you looked at it. So
source 9 from, yeah. From the Meiri?
Sorry, no, 10. For Sotah. So, spend a minute reading it so you get a feel, those of you who didn't look at it at all.
Number
what?
You'll learn through.
We should learn all. Fine. So I'm going to read through, but I want you to share your thoughts as I do. Beseda, I'll read and translate, but when if there are things that came up in your chavruta, share them. Beseda? Not all of them, okay. One of the beautiful things that happens in Sotah, which happens in a few places in the Gemara, is pitom, there's a midrash on verses, okay? There's a few such places, and in Sotah, there's a whole big midrash about Yetziat Mitzrayim. Okay, so the verse is, they made their life impossible with hard work, chomer uvenim, building blocks. Said Rabbah, בתחילה בחומר ובלבנים ולבסוף בכל עבודה בשדה. The continuation of the verse is עבודת השדה. So first it was challenging because they had to build the blocks and then they had to work in the fields. את כל עבודתם אשר עבדו בהם בפרך, אמר רבי שמואל בר נחמני, אמר רבי יונתן, שהיו מחליפים מלאכת אנשים לנשים ומלאכת נשים לאנשים. So what was the עבודת פרך? They gave you work that was inappropriate. Mm-hmm. Okay, now you hear here that there's an essentialist perception of people, okay? There's work that fits men, and there's work that fits women.
So, can I just ask? This is not from our chavruta, because we did not get to it, and it's a question. It seems to me there's at least two understandings here of what that means. One is, you know, giving work to women that they couldn't do physically, that was more appropriate for men who are, on average, stronger, but certainly many strong women and vice versa. So in other words, it could be work that is considered, that is physically inappropriate, or it could be somehow the humiliation, like that in a society where work is gender bifurcated, giving men women's work and giving women men's work would be humiliating and undermining of their humanity. Which are you thinking this is? Okay. I'm just saying the second is not essentialist. Actually, neither in a way is essentialist, but the second... Both kind of recognize that there are divisions, cultural divisions, but the second is different.
So that's what I want to say. I want to say that when you turn culture upside down, that is humiliating. Yeah. That is also crumbling. It kills society, okay? So you're right that even if we read it culturally rather than in an essentialist way, it's a deep breaking apart of society, okay? Yeah. Okay, I'm jumping to the end of the line. That sentence refers to what happened before. The Rash Rabbi Avia, and I'm at the top of page 7. Bischar nashim tzidkaniyot shehayu beoto hador nigalu Yisrael mimitzrayim. With the merit or the reward that was given to the righteous women of that generation, Bnei Yisrael were redeemed from Egypt. Where did this verse, where did this statement come from? Yesh me'ayin. Okay, I don't know where it came from. Nachon? Okay, it's mamash yesh me'ayin, this midrash.
Right.
I'm just joking. Ken. So now they're going to describe the tzidkaniyot. Okay. בשעה שהולכות לשאוב מים, the women would go and get water, draw water from the Nile. הקדוש ברוך הוא מזמן להם דגים קטנים בחדיהן. God would produce little fish to come into their buckets of water. ושואבות מחץ המים ומחץ הדגים. Why dagim? What is it?
It's fruitfulness.
נכון, it's the symbol of fruitfulness, okay? ראש השנה, right? ובאות ושופטות שתי גדרות, אחת של חמים ואחת של דגים, and they put these two pots on the fire, one with water and one with fish. ומוליכות אצל בעליהם לשדה. And they would take this water and fish to their husbands in the field, right? We just read that the husbands are working in the field. But there's an underlying assumption, נכון, that the husbands don't come home. Why would they not come home?
They have to work continuously to reach their quotas.
That's one possibility, נכון, that it's פשוט עבודת פרך is endless, okay?
Or
נכון?
Or they're avoiding their wives.
Or they're avoiding their wives. Why would they be avoiding their wives?
Because they don't have sons.
They don't want to have sons, okay? What's the point of having sons when there's the decree that the sons are going to be killed? Okay, so the assumption of the Midrash is that the men are keeping away because they don't want children.
So there is another version of this that's, I think it's Midrash that's slightly different, that presumes that the men are not feeling very sexual. They're feeling exhausted. They're not feeling human. They're not, and that,
they have headaches.
And that their wives, that what we're about to see is that their wives kind of arousing them back to humanity and masculinity and arousing their sexual desire, that they couldn't even think
that
of themselves as sexual beings. So,
did you want to? Okay. Nachon, nachon, that's nice.
It's a whole other.
Nachon.
Does the Gemara have a consciousness that only one gender has sexual desire?
They could both have. Yeah. It's,
so if women have more in the Talmud and these guys turn into women, it's almost like doubly surprising, but they're not.
But women are also, I don't want to go there. It's also women are passive. Too much. ומלחיצות אותן. So this is Sue, where you were going, נכון? ומלחיצות אותן וסקות אותן ומאכילות אותן ומשקות אותן ונזקקות להן בין שפתיים. Right? They would bathe them and anoint them, the women to the men. That's exactly the description you were giving, and they would feed them and give them to drink, and then they would have sex with them בין שפתיים. שנאמר, אל תשכבון בין שפתיים. בשכר תשכבון בין שפתיים, זכו ישראל לביזת מצרים. They found some private place in the fields, okay? And as a reward, they also got all the spoils, mm-hmm. Yeah, from Egypt. Okay, we don't have enough time to get into this midrash. שנאמר כנפי יודן לחפה בכסף, עברותיה בירק רק חרות. Okay. כיוון שמתעברות, once they get pregnant, they go back home, באות לבתיהם. וכיוון שמגיע זמן הולדתן, now they have to give birth. Now what are they going to do? נכון, פרעו said, going to kill all the kids. הולכות ויולדות בשדה תחת התפוח. They go and they give birth in the field under the apple trees. I don't think it's apple in Shir HaShirim. I don't think apples existed in Eretz Israel at the time. שנאמר תחת התפוח אורחתיך, והקדוש ברוך הוא, now God comes in. ושולח משמי מרום, מי שמנקיר ומשפיר אותם. A heavenly angel, maybe, who takes care of... Now, not clear if this is the babies or the mothers, okay? You'll tell me in a minute what you think. כחיה זו שמשפרת את הולד. Now, think of this image, right? It's an image of God as a woman giving birth, okay? And taking care of the offspring. Okay? שנאמר, ומולדתך ביום מולדתך אותך. Now we're into יחזקאל. לא קרת צריך ובמים לא רוחץ למשעי. Okay, it's the earlier verses in Yechezkel of this baby that is thrown and no one is taking care of this baby. But God comes, ומלקט להם שני עיגולים. God brings oil and honey. שנאמר, ויניקהו דבש מסלע. Now God is a mother who nurses. Okay. וכיוון okay, so God took care of the babies. Now what happens? כיוון שמכירים בהם מצרים, באים להורגן. Of course, the Egyptians come and kill want to kill the kids. They're almost like they go back into the womb in a certain way. Okay, so the babies are swallowed by the earth, and the Egyptians bring bulls, and they plow the fields to get the babies out. But they fail to find the babies. The Egyptians go, and after they go, the babies emerge like plants out of the fields. Now the revava is not what's interesting, right? But what's interesting is ketzemach hasadeh netatich. And I wonder if this is being echoed in the Agadah. Okay? Kivan shemagdilim ba'im adarim adarim levatehem. Now, who's coming to back to Mitzrayim? These mature kids, right? They're not babies. They come as mature, almost grown-ups. Herds and herds of these babies who were born in the fields now are young women, men, I guess, primarily, who come back into Mitzrayim. שנאמר ותרבי ותגדלי ותבואי בעדי ידיים, אל תקריא עדי ידיים אלא בעדי אדרים, which who are like herds of sheep and cattle. Just so we hear the last line of the Midrash, וכשנגלה הקדוש ברוך הוא על הים, הם הכירו תחילה. When God appeared in Yam Suf, these kids are the ones who recognize God first. Of course, you recognize your parents, okay? שנאמר זה אלי ואנדאו. Okay. Ha, share some thoughts. What do you make of this Midrash? Can you want to tell me what stream of feminism you think it's from? Liberal, radical, or cultural?
I just have to say, because it feels like there's just some wonderful gender fluidity here. Like it doesn't, like God is coming and is a midwife and is a nursing mother, and then God is a, I don't know if it's in this midrash or a different version of it, but God is a young man who, you know, they say, you know,
Zeli van Veru.
Like, oh, that's the guy that took care of us. Like, it's just I think it's incredible from that point of view. I don't know how to characterize it. I'll leave it up to you. I don't know if it falls into this.
Yofi. Okay, so first of all, there's a lot of good that there isn't a clear gender for God here as a man, which is what we're used to. Nachon. Which is, that's cultural feminism, right? Because it says that God can be great and amazing and feminine. Okay, so it's, let's flip the hierarchies. Okay, it's still an essentialist woman's qualities. Okay, but it's, let's give its weight. Uh-huh. Yes.
I was going to also go along those lines, just for the example of this, when the gender roles, despite the gender roles in terms of the work and the slavery was flipped, but the women still are the ones who are preparing the food, washing and bathing the men, and it emphasizes that they merit the nest. They're the ones who are the heroes of the story, because of their ability to perform these things and maintain them.
Manian, because they're heroes for insisting on maintaining their classic gender role.
They
do their roles to an extreme, or under terrible circumstances, they manage to maintain it. It's mamash a rejection, like you're saying, of the Egyptian attempt to flip. Okay, they were able to maintain their culture of women doing what women are supposed to do, and so on. Okay, Yofi.
Avital, do you make anything of the fact that when the Egyptians, after these children are born, v'chevan shemakirim bahem Mitzrayim ba'im lehorgan, and then at the end of the Midrash,
hem ekiruhu?
Yeah. What I was thinking is, the Egyptians, it's hakara l'shem mavet, and hikiru is, at the end, is hakara l'shem...
So I think it's another opposition between the Mitzrim and Israel. Nachon, Nachon, yafe.
And there's an opposition between God and the Egyptians, because in plowing, they're doing a very masculine kind of activity, and God is doing all these feminine things.
Nachon. I thought you were going to say that they're plowing to kill, and usually plowing is for life and for, right? Okay, so it's a continuation of those oppositions. The Egyptians are doing all these things for death. Okay.
Don't they also use that same verb for the sexual act?
Which verb?
Plowing.
Mm.
In this,
I don't know it in Hebrew as a, as a, as a, might be. I don't have a recollection of it in the Gemara, but it might, doesn't mean that it's not there. Manian.
I was going to say the opposite too, like the plowing is usually for birth and the burying is usually for death.
Yeah. Nachon. Exactly. And here the burying is just, yeah. Nachon. It's interesting that I thought of it not as burying, but as going back into the womb. But the truth is that in the Gemara, the womb is called kever. Okay? So, okay, there's a tremendous amount more to say about this. I want to finish up the Passover passages, I want to point out to a couple of things, okay? We're going to look at this backwards for a minute. Let's go to page 5. Let's look for 1 minute, 1, 2, and 3, okay? Page 5. Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi claims, Nashim, we looked at it for a minute, but I want to say one more thing about it. Nashim are obligated in Arba Kosot because they were also part of the miracle. Comes Rashi and says, he quotes the Sotah that we just looked at. So what's he saying? He's saying, Afem ayu be'oto anes, women aren't part because they're equal. They're part because when they're much, much better. Okay? Now you can say, liberal feminism is going to be in favor of aflaya mitakenet.
Affirmative action.
Affirmative action, thank you. I'm sorry, it's jet lag is hitting me and my English is... So, those are legitimate tools. Now, it's a question if women have to prove themselves even more. We often feel it in society. But their inclusion, according to Rashi, is because they played these unique roles. That's why he brings Sotah in. Okay? Now, beautifully
implying
comes...
Implying had they not.
Nachon, right. Nachon, exactly.
No, so that's okay? A mixed bag, because it's not really...
Certain women are.
Right. It's not a mixed bag. It's annoying. And it's not what... And it's not what the Gemara is saying, so it makes it even more annoying, okay? And Tosfot comes and...
Could you just explain the
shift?
The liberal feminism, like this, you're saying this is an example of liberal feminism?
What I'm saying is liberal feminism will say, fine, we want women to be apart. You can read the Gemara that way. But liberal feminism also would legitimate for that purpose affirmative action, and might also say, you know, if women want to be equal in society, I have to take women of better quality for the first few years so that then they can, okay. So I think it's not totally foreign to it.
Hence that expression we used to hear, and I can't remember how it goes, but somebody else might, in order for women to accomplish the same thing as men, they have to be twice as smart, work twice as hard.
So it's annoying and you want to criticize it. I think that line also holds in it some criticism. Okay, but it also is a reflection of a reality we know.
Right, exactly.
Okay? Now what's fascinating is that Tosfot in Source 3 catches it and comes and says, why? Nachon, ayu be'oto anes, peresh ha-Rashbam, she'al yadam nig'alu, because through women they were saved. And it's the same thing in Megillat Esther. And now Tosfot says, v'kashe, this is difficult. Why does Rashi and the Rashbam, why do they say that? De af, right? The word af means also. And the Gemara says also. And that means she'enan ikar. It means they didn't have a central role. They were just a part. Okay, so he's saying, dear Rashbam, dear Rashi, you're not reading the Gemara the way the pshat is. And then he quotes the Yerushalmi ve'ode b'Yerushalmi garas. There the version is, she'af hem ayu be'oto safek. They were under the same threat to be killed. Okay, in Megillat Esther, in Esther. And we hear from this, be'ota sakana, she'lashmid, la'rog u'le'abed. Okay, so he's criticizing the read of the necessity for women to be even more. Okay?
He's criticizing their inclusion?
No, their exclusion. Only certain women, according to Rashi and Rashbam, only certain women would have been.
That I don't. I'm not sure I agree with you with that. I think
We're all included.
Let's try and
because of their
zchut. We're all included because of their zchut, and the women, but that the women needed to be much more. Now, I think I agree with you, Lyle, that when I include women because they were extra tzidkaniyot, and because of them everyone was saved, that's really a mechanism of exclusion. Because it means that as a norm, women are not apart. Okay? And that's why it's fascinating to see the Tosfot catch it. Okay?
Is he saying that he disagrees with the inclusion of women at all?
No. Okay. He is saying they should be included as a norm rather than as unique.
The rationale the rationale of because they were so righteous.
Because it could be read both ways.
Marcia had a great comparison to I can't remember. I'm sorry. Marcia was just saying, there was a 9/11 memorial.
Oh, really?
And do you want me to repeat?
Yeah, please.
No, she said it's as if we talked about those who survived 9/11 and only talked about the rescuers and didn't take into account like the vast majority of people who just walked through the ash, like as if somehow they weren't there because they didn't do some heroic thing.
Act.
They survived. They were liberated. They were, you know, they survived this terrible ordeal.
Yeah. Nachon.
In the Psachim context, is it in the parak with Arvei Psachim?
This is
which quote?
The Psachim quote they're working with from Kuklet.
I think so.
It
is.
It's
all about, in the mission they're working with, it's like, that even the poor people should, it's basically like the
Ken, it's that Mishnah.
Right, so the poor people should be a part of it. Children, like the whole element that everyone's inclusive in this, which I think is interesting, like women are obligated in these four cups and speaking to the experience and Tosafot by saying their part, I think like he's flattening it in a radical feminist move that's saying, basically is what you're saying, but I think the context is helpful in the Gemara, that the experience of the Seder is supposed to equalize everyone. And like we said, in the numbers and the statistics, women aren't necessarily accounted for. And that someone could misread Rashi as being extremely progressive by bringing the women up and elevating them, but actually by making them exceptional, it's not. And that's not the purpose of the Seder either. And like any close reader of the Seder would see through that.
So I'm going to say one more thing. You know, the company in which women are included is very significant. When you include women and children, I guess I don't have to say anything. When you include nashim gerim ve'avadim, okay, women, converts, strangers, and slaves, you're saying something else, right? It's different forms of citizenship, responsibility. And I think in this Mishnah, when you're including with children and aniyim, and with the poor, you're blurring, you're saying women can be on par with the men because the aniyim are there, because the poor are there.
Sorry, which Mishnah?
Okay. The Mishnah that is the source for this Gemara that we're quoting in Psachim, okay, includes, just like you're saying, Behemet, women, children, and aniyim, and the poor. When I include only women and children, it's this category of people who don't really have responsibility, who aren't full citizens, and so on and so forth. But when I include them with the aniyim, I think there's a way that it's even that there's a potential for even more equality. What are we going to do that our time is almost up and we didn't do Akedat Yitzchak? Yeah. What? You want to skip Akedat Yitzchak? Beseder. You'll have to look at the Hasava. I just have to say that we have to remember that on source 8, that the Rama says that all the women, all kol anashim shelanu nikraot chashuvot. That's it. We can discuss it tomorrow in the Midrash.
Pretty good for Krakow.
Now let's look at Akedat Yitzchak. It's the Rama. No. It's always in different. It's the Shulchan Aruch and it's the Rama on it. Is that all? Okay. Akedat Yitzchak. Where's the drama taking place in the verses?
Where isn't it?
Okay, what's the relationship that is center stage in the verses? What?
Hashem and Abraham.
Hashem and Abraham. And what's the content of the drama?
I'm not sure what you mean by content.
In other words, it's the moment.
Will Abraham, you know, listen to this, you know, this command?
Yofi, and so, and it's the Kierkegaard kind of read of the leap of faith. That is the peak, right, of what happens in the relationship between them. Okay, Abraham erasing himself and saying, I give myself over to your will. Okay, mm-hmm. You can already hear that radical feminism, cultural feminism may not read it that way. I'm not sure that it's about erasing myself. It is about giving a lot into the relationship, but not being present in it. Okay, Yofi. Yes, you had a different suggestion?
The father-son relationship.
The father-son relationship,
and it's
okay.
So intimate. I mean, not only does the whole chapter exclude the mother, which we'll get to, but the idea that the language that they use between each other has echoes of the Lech Lecha moment.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just the pathos as they're going up the mountain and he's realizing what's going on.
Nachon. Avi Sagi has, I think, a heartbreaking read of this. Avi Sagi, he's a professor of philosophy and cultural studies in Bar-Ilan, and he suggests that what a parent, what Avraham does, is the ultimate sacrifice towards Yitzchak by erasing himself. That what a parent, the most a parent can do for their child, is to move backstage so the child gets center stage. But it's impossible. He basically assumes it's impossible for the two to exist simultaneously. Okay, I think that's partially why I find it heartbreaking. And that's why, after this, Avraham doesn't...
talk to each other.
They never talk to each other. They don't appear simultaneously, okay, ever again. And so that actually the sacrifice is Avraham's kind of taking a step back, mm-hmm. and that's what happens here. It's a read of a, which also, Ron, this, what you're saying is, it's a zero-sum game read, right? It's either God's will or Avraham. It's either Avraham or Yitzchak. We can't imagine that there's a negotiating that would leave both our wills together, intact, at play, okay? One of us has to erase ourselves for the other. Okay, that's the ultimate sacrifice. Okay. Other thoughts about this? Okay. So I think there's two voices that I wanted to give an opportunity to hear. One is in it's the later Midrashim in which Yitzchak takes on the role of the person who's going to put in the center the relationship between Avraham and Sarah. Mm-hmm. Okay? And Yitzchak says to Avraham, you're ignoring your responsibilities, your relationship with Sarah, with what you're doing. Forget about me. Yeah. Okay? But that's the epitome of what you're doing. Right? Be'otah sha'ah nafal pachad. Yitzchak plays here a feminine kind of role. He has emotions. He's terrified. We don't hear Avraham being terrified. Yitzchak is terrified. He understands that there's no goat, right? There's nothing for the Avraham to sacrifice. Okay? He doesn't see in his hand anything to give as a sacrifice. And he sensed what was coming.
It's also an intuition,
which is more right,
feminine.
Which is nachon.
It's a feminine it's an intuition which would ordinarily be identified with feminine.
Nachon. Bikesh lomar haya aseh leolah. He wanted to say, but where's the animal? Amar lo, ho'il ve'amarta hakadosh baruch hu bachar becha. Avraham says to him, im kvar, you're asking me the question, God has chosen you. Let's be honest. Responds Yitzchak, Im bachar bi, harei nafshi netuna lo. I'm willing. I'm giving him my soul. Al dmei imi tzar li me'od. Okay? Al imi tzar li me'od. Now you see that there's two versions here of the Midrash, and I think that's also interesting. Many of the prints have al dami tzar li me'od. And only in some manuscripts they have imi. Okay? And I think that's also telling. I think there's something unbearable about Yitzhak's call to Avraham, you are erasing this relationship. Okay, you're breaking this relationship with my mother when you do this.
Could that also be kind of a cheap shot at his dad?
It is a cheap shot at his dad.
Not a cheap shot, but a expensive
shot. Yeah.
Biduk. Way to cut to the... Yeah, he's a, you know, I'll do this, but I guess mom's the only one who's going to care.
He's suffering.
Yeah. Because, you know, not that you will, or not that I acknowledge that this is going to be difficult for you, or not yet.
Nachon, if he, Yitzhak, is doing something, it's... You're right, he is assuming, he is portraying his father as emotionless. Okay, as not caring about it. Yeah.
But he's a willing
participant.
Like he's saying, count me in. And by the way, it's gonna cause a lot of pain to Abraham. But the Midrash adds a voice to Abraham that wasn't there, because Abraham didn't say to him, "It's gonna be you." He actually said something that you could say was best of circumstances, but it was some barely compassionate, but compassionate nonetheless. Not telling him what's going to happen and saying, God will provide. You know, and this is and the Midrash is making Abraham just be really a bit more callous.
Nachon.
Honest, definitely, but we are acknowledging that somebody's going to be pained by this experience at the end of the Midrash. And it's not going to be Abraham.
I just want to say that in
Biduk,
that if you look at verse 8, there are two ways to read it. Vayomer Avraham, Elohim yar'eh lo hase le'ola, bni. God will show, my dear son, God will show us the sacrifice. But you could read le'ola bni. My son is the sacrifice. Okay? So this midrash is a play on that, on where how you punctuate this verse. Okay? So there's... Yeah. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Can I go back to, I think it's Lawrence, is that your name? What Lawrence was saying.
Wait, you guys are still on the verse?
Yeah. We're looking at the trope.
Okay. Sue, yes.
I want to go back to something you said about the kind of the big patriarch and the little patriarch, where in that sense, in that context, you were talking about society and the, you know, the individual father and his home. Here I want to say God is the mm-hmm. big patriarch, because it's not only, and maybe not even primarily, the relationship with Avraham that Sarah is cut out of. She's being cut out of this whole, you know, this is God's project. He's, you know, Isaac says in this midrash, if he's chosen, that's what God chosen. My life is given to him, but I grieve for my mother. So it's, I don't think we should leave God out of the thing that she is being left out of. Does that make sense?
Yeah. And what do you want to say about his role?
I just to the you know there are other sort of feminist reads that we haven't spoken about, and one is just not assuming that when we're looking at classical texts that you know we are going to have to bring the feminist angle, but to assume that maybe there's some unselfconscious feminist impulses in it. And I feel like this Baal Midrash is seeing this like this big male violent thing going on, and is saying there is a grieving mother who is not in this picture, but introducing her to the picture, which I don't care if none of Chazal would have called themselves feminists. I think that is a move that overlaps with feminism to be able to say, to draw attention to the fact that there are no women in this picture, and to just think about what that means for the family, for gender. I think it's a very heartbreakingly beautiful move, and just it's and more than just a familial one. I think it says something about, you know, what's going on theologically. It's heavy. There's just a lot to it.
Nahon, I want to go back to what I said when I opened this class.
Yeah.
I think that these theories do two things. One is they add interpretations to the text.
Right.
Okay? For me, I don't think I would have read the three options of how to read Dvarim without some of the feminist theory. It clicked. But I totally agree that we hear and understand implications in the text differently when we're aware of it. And I want to stress that I agree with you that I think many of these voices are in the texts already.
Yeah.
And it's about uncovering them and giving them space and room and legitimacy and all these things we want to say. Yes. I think we're going to end. Whoever didn't read Marion McNaughton's Midrash
read
should read it. Okay.
Immediately.
But what I do want to, but I want to just to end by strengthening, Sue, some of what you're saying, is to say that some of her intuitions of how we understand the relationship with the divine are there in the conversation between Abraham and God at Sodom. I think there's little that needs to be reinvented. There are voices that need to be heard.
I think she's also drawing from Eshet Manoah.
Yes.
And who sees in the judgment?
Nahon. So I think so. It's worth an in-depth analysis. But I'm saying that these are voices that exist within the tradition, and that the theoretical sides are tools for us to hear it.
Yeah.
But I would say, I guess the big but is, I mean, I think we all, I think the self-selecting mm-hmm. group here is with that. I think, I mean, we were talking about whether you would use this with congregants and on the high holidays. Like, I think the male versus female God, I think will still, for many people, will just, like, it, you know, it's pagan, it's, mm-hmm. like, it kind of...
Right.
Right. I don't think so. You don't
think so? Not at all. You know what? I hear you, but I think part of what I want to say is that the Midrash in Sotah does that work for you.
Yeah.
Because there is God as a midwife, as a mother who's nursing, as a person giving birth. In other words, I think there are enough openings in the tradition to enable it.
The conflict between the two of them
is very...
The other, we have to sort of...
It's
right. The other side.
It might be that the work is more about understanding implications when we present these midrashim.
I really
yes, Ron.
So I just want to say that I think some people might read this. I'll call it a midrash of Mary McNaughton, and just dismiss it as like, somebody reading into the text, right? Like, you know, it's a nice take, but it doesn't really hold water. And I think that. Maybe Rachel, I'll just say I accept the challenge. You know, I think we need to offer different perspectives to our congregants, whatever congregations we serve, and men and women, boys and girls. And I think that I felt like crying. You know, I it's like moving out of the head and into the heart. I think is really what we're called.
But Ron, I said to Rachel, I'd love to use this on high holidays. But as a female rabbi, I'm going to take way more flack in mm-hmm. certain kinds of ways. But if you brought it, it would be accepted in a heard in a different kind of way. Then there she goes again with the feminist stuff, you know. Not all, but I'm just saying there's a certain... I'm probably still going to use it. Like, I really love it. So
I know a way
to soften it.
It's not
going to scare me away, but it's just hard, you know.
I know a way to soften it or pave the road for it. So there's another midrash, and I don't have the citation off the top of my head, but I can bring it tomorrow. And it's a classic midrash that, in fact, what happened here is Abraham misunderstood, misinterpreted God. When God said, Vahalehu, God said, raise him up and celebrate him.
Mm-hmm. Right. Don't offer him up
is a sacrifice.
Right.
Right.
So that's already there in the classical tradition.
Right.
But it's not the same as it's not a female god.
Right. Not just the female god, but like Sarah and the female god have like understanding each other in a way that guys just don't get. Like, you know, no, I'm just saying that.
Not all guys.
I don't think it's a female god.
The Abraham god.
I think it's how women might understand God and how men might understand God. Not that God is male or female.
For sure. So it would be a discussion. Yes, it would be. Yes, for discussion. Yes, no question.
I think we got a very good example of actually how to present it, is what I'm trying to show them. You know, there is a folklore about feminism in this country that is rampant, and there's not an understanding of what actually the feminist movements actually are. And so starting out the way you did, by explaining what was their purpose and what was their point and how did they come out, definitely, you know, had me take a step back and say, okay, so the effect is to try to say, well, maybe the way that we're doing it, if it's cultural feminism, if I got it correct, that, you know, it may be the way we're doing things don't have to be the way that we need to do things, and we could look at the process of how we get to that understanding of the story, and not look at it in a hierarchical way or things like that. That helps. I think if you just come right out, the problem you're doing is that you are letting them have their frame of reference of what feminism is, and then you're speaking to that.
Right.
So if you broke that down a little bit, soften the ground a little bit, and say, this is what, when I'm talking about feminism, this is what I'm talking about, this is how we're going to look at it, and the purpose of that is to look at, you know, our culture or society like this. Yeah. Now let's look at this text and all that, and just set that ground, because, you know.
So it's how you plow the field, is that what you're saying?
Touché.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. To learn more with Hadar, please visit hadar.org/Torah.